From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. On today's show, Michelle and Barack Obama are executive producers of a documentary that's up for an Academy Award. Then, the final episodes of BoJack Horseman are out today. Series creator Raphael Bob Waxberg tells us what's behind the absurd show.
This is a wacky comedy about talking animals getting into scrapes. We take it very seriously, and we talk about, like, what is the emotional journey of these characters, and what are we saying about art and about the fleeting nature of happiness.
And Glenn Keane, the animator who shared an Academy Award with Kobe Bryant for the short film Dear Basketball. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. 1 year ago, at the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, the documentary American Factory made its debut. Soon after, it was scooped up by Michelle and Barack Obama's production company named Higher Ground for distribution on Netflix. American Factory is now up for Best Documentary at the Academy Awards. The film tells the story of what happened when a Chinese auto glass company called Fu Yao opened in a vacant General Motors plant in Ohio. The film was directed by Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert. They also made the 2009 short film The Last Truck, Closing of a GM Plant, which in some ways is a prequel to American Factory. Here are the filmmakers with John Horn.
The film The Last Truck had been on HBO and had the great fortune of being an Oscar nominee. And we were very, very proud of that film, but we thought that chapter of our filmmaking was over. And then in 2014, that dead factory was bought by a Chinese billionaire entrepreneur who owns the largest manufacturer of windshields, of auto glass in the world. And he bought this dead factory and said, I'm going to reopen it, and we're going to start making windshields in America.
We established relationships with a lot of people who worked in that plant, and they trusted us. Workers in Dayton, Ohio, really embraced that film. So when we went in there to talk to the workers on the line, and we were like, yeah, we made The Last Truck, it was like instant trust.
Well, you have the trust of some of these former GM workers, but much more important to the making of this film is the trust of Fu Yao, because they give you access that is beyond comprehension. And you are in some incredibly candid moments. So how did you go about approaching Fu Yao, and what was your pitch to them, and why did they invite you in?
When we were talking to the company, we said we would do it if it was independent, we owned it, and we had editorial control, and we can't take any money from the company to do this. And they agreed. And it was largely the chairman. The chairman is, you know, he's over 70, he's a maverick, and he said, let's do it, let's make it real. And along the way, and during the 3 years of filming, there was more than one occasion when he said to his people around him, this is a documentary, it's not a promotional film for Fu Yao, it's a real documentary, so go with it. He kind of told his team, we're going to let this happen, and that was huge for us.
Especially in a country like China, where people are kind of used to, you know, the leader, you follow whatever they say, you fall in line. So people did. I mean, his presidents, his vice presidents, his management, they might not have always liked us being there, but they were told by the chairman we had to be let in.
We're talking with Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert. They're the co-directors of the documentary American Factory. There are so many different stories that are happening in this film. One is how American workers are adapting to their new managers and their new manager's view of how a factory should be operated. And then there's another part of the story, which are the Chinese workers who are living in the United States. They are cut off from their families for years at a time. They're living in what we would not call, you know, very nice housing. They're making very little money. How important was it to this film to make sure that they were represented and what they were going through? Because as an American worker might see it, what they were going through was not at all pleasant.
When we started the film, our sort of sensibility, our point of view was rooted and grounded in our Midwestern blue-collar folks that we know and love. And as we were in that factory, we started realizing there's a whole other community, and we are far on the outside of that community, but they're essential to this story. They're totally crucial to the story. We had to ask ourselves, like, how do we try to access those folks who don't speak English. And that's when we brought on our two Chinese co-producers, Yichen Zhang and Mijia Li, who started coming to Ohio, going into the factory with us every day. It was hard for us as Midwesterners and white folks and, you know, non-Asian folks to try to get into those communities. But with these two awesome producers, we eventually did.
In the midst of filming, something happens that you probably might have guessed could happen, but certainly couldn't have 100% predicted, and that is that there's a move to unionize the factory.
We didn't expect there to be a union vote. We didn't know it was going to happen. Something we really started learning about, though, and wanting to document, was the union avoidance company that was brought in at very big expense by the company. And that is called Labor Relations Institute. There are lots of these kind of companies all across the country. They were paid well over $1 million to fight the union.
And to actively discourage workers to vote against unionization.
Yeah. The company itself, we later learned when we started getting translations of some of the Chinese, also like kind of taught their supervisors to be anti-union and how to get rid of workers who were pro-union.
Which is actually against the law.
Which, of course, is against the law, and it should be against the law. Because how do workers get a voice if they can't organize and without fear of being fired? And so many people were fired.
I got the phone call from Fu Yao that they had fired me. I really, truly feel like that they targeted me. I was on the news. I was at the city council meetings.
At the same time, we wanted to include anti-union voices in the film.
Including workers who say
very articulately why they're opposed to unions. And it's wonderfully complicated because in China, every worker is in a union. And their relationship to their union and their company is really different than it is in the United States. But it's so fascinating that a huge socialist country has become like the greatest capitalist country in the world.
Stephen and Julia, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. This is fun.
Thanks, John.
Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichertz are the directors of American Factory. It has an Oscar nomination for Best Feature Documentary. Coming up on The Frame, with the final episodes of BoJack Horseman out today on Netflix, we revisit our interview with series creator Raphael Bob Waxberg. With the final episodes of BoJack Horseman dropping today on Netflix, we revisit John Horne's 2016 interview with series creator Raphael Bob Waxberg. He said he's an avid fan of the Academy Awards and wanted the series' third season to explore the machine behind Hollywood's biggest night.
I love the Oscars. Every year I get really into it, and I handicap my favorites, and so I get really excited about it. But it also makes me anxious in a way as well when I take a step back and think about that these are people who were kind of parading around and pageanting around an insane, mad dash of picture opportunities and interviews and just being shepherded from place to place like cattle. It terrifies me the way we treat these human beings and thrust them into the spotlight and say, you know, dance for us and we will throw gold at you. I'm fascinated by what that does to a person.
It must have been interesting for you and your writers to have observed all of this, to kind of unburden that experience and the pressure to win awards and the length that people will go to. Was that a kind of a collaborative idea that everybody brought some sort of personal experience to the way in which they wanted to tell this story?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I got to say, I've never really understood the appeal of awards. And then we won an award this last year. We got the Critics' Choice Award. And all of a sudden, I got it. And I was like, when I win awards, this feels nice. Now I understand how good this feels, because it's so dumb and it doesn't mean anything. But, you know, I think we all want to be liked. It's people on a stage saying, we like you. You know, we all want that Sally Field moment. It's human nature. And I think if we could somehow turn that off, maybe we'd all be a lot healthier. And so as you can tell, I'm pretty conflicted about the whole business. But I think a big part of this season of BoJack is exploring that. And like, does this matter? And what does it mean? And will it make you happy? And the answer to all those questions are no and yes and something and nothing and maybe and no and yes.
In this season, you have Angela Bassett playing the publicist who is hired to win BoJack his Oscar and conduct his campaign. She was actually nominated for an Oscar for What's Love Got to Do with It back in 1994. Let's listen to a scene with Angela Bassett.
All right.
I don't know if I should win an Oscar. I don't know if I want to.
Stop punishing yourself.
I'm not in the movie. I was in New Mexico.
None of that matters. All that matters now is the story.
What is my story?
I'll tell you. This has been your dream for the last 30 years. You made it happen. An Oscar won't make you happy forever. It won't solve all your problems. You win that Oscar. The next day, you go back to being you. But that night is a really good night.
I mean, it kind of says everything you're talking about, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was a really important scene for us. Because a big theme on the show is that the thing you think you want, once you get it, won't make you happy. And that it's the wanting that's the thing. To ever get that thing is just going to make you want the next thing. And that's something we've kind of hammered in over and over again. So when we were starting the season and in the writing of it, thinking like, okay, this season's going to be about BoJack trying to get an Oscar. You know, the first question is our audience going to care about this? Because we've been telling them for the last 2 years that anything BoJack wants, it's not going to make him happy. So this scene was a little bit about kind of explaining in a new way what it means, not just for the career, but the idea that, no, it won't lead to lasting happiness, but it will have a moment of happiness. And you shouldn't throw out the hope of a moment of happiness because of the threat of looming sadness, if that makes sense.
We're talking with Raphael Bob Waksberg. He's the creator and executive producer of BoJack Horseman. Not that long ago, we had a high school friend of yours, Lisa Hannawalt, on the show, and she talked a little bit about the process of creating these characters. Let's listen to Lisa from an earlier appearance on our show.
I talked to Raphael, the creator, about what he envisioned for the characters. We knew each other in high school. We were friends. So he can be like, oh, do you remember like that kid in our math class? Like, draw him as a dog.
who was the friend in the math class, and does he resent being turned into a dog?
I'll never tell. That's our secret.
Okay.
You know, it's funny because that quote reminded me, this is a show about cartoon animals, you know? And I think from our conversation, if you don't know the show, it's easy to miss that this is a wacky comedy about talking animals getting into scrapes. And then, you know, we think about it, we take it very seriously, and we talk about, like, what is the emotional journey of these characters, and what are we saying about art and about the fleeting nature of happiness and love. But we're also telling wacky jokes about dogs who, you know, love tennis balls. And that is kind of, for me, the fun of the show is playing both instruments at once.
In episode 2 of this current season, there's a quick shot of a bank. There's a window advertisement saying, refinance if you dare. And then there's a Subway sandwich shop. You spell Subway a little bit differently, but it's a Subway sandwich shop.
For legal reasons.
With a sign saying, kids eat free. And so you know that the store's advertising spokesman, Jared Fogel, is a convicted pedophile. It's a pretty sick joke. So how do you guys come up with the background jokes, and how far is maybe too far?
First of all, most of the background jokes come from Lisa and her team of designers. And there are two kinds of background jokes. There are jokes that are baked into the background, like the ones you described. And then we also a lot of times have animal jokes kind of right before a scene starts or after a scene ends, where you'll see like a funny animal move through the scene in a funny way, just as we're establishing the scene. And that usually comes from Mike Hollingsworth, who's our supervising director, or the other directors or animators. But all of them, I think, are so smart and so funny. And I love the fact that this show is a collaboration. You know, one of the things we're constantly looking at when we're editing the episodes or we're looking at the animatics is where there's more opportunity for jokes. What else can we cram into this section? And this is a show that people watch more than once. They watch over and over. And so the more things we can hide and the more things we can have going at once, the more things there are to find.
I remember in the early years of Saturday Night Live, there was a skit that was proposed for a fake commercial. It was called Placenta Helper, like Hamburger Helper. And everybody said, good idea, but way too far. Was there an equivalent for you on BoJack where it like sounded good and you're like, nah, we can't do that?
Yes. You know, in season 2, we reintroduced J.D. Salinger as a character. And he returns with this game show, Hollywood Stars and Celebrities. What do they know? Do they know things? Let's find out. And there's a story where he has a pen. And he tells his crew, you know, at the end of today, I'm going to give this pen to the person that I respect the most. And our other character, Todd, who J.D. Salinger hates, ends up with the pen more through trickery than by earning it. And Todd says, I got your pen. That means you respect me. And J.D. Salinger says, no, I don't. And the original line was, he says, ah, you're twisting my words. This is like Mark David Chapman all over again. Which is a pretty dark joke. Mark David Chapman, that's the name, right?
Yeah, the person who killed John Lennon.
Right. So Mark David Chapman killed John Lennon, and he said it was because of J.D. Salinger. And so that's a pretty dark joke. But, you know, time has passed, and we thought maybe it's okay to laugh about that now. And then, unrelatedly, we ended up with Paul McCartney in one of our episodes. And then I thought, well, if there's a chance that Paul McCartney watches this show, then this joke is going to bum him out specifically. And I don't want to be the guy who's like, hey, come on my show, and then here's a joke about your dead friend. So no subject matter is necessarily off limits. But I do like to think, like, who could potentially be hurt by this joke? And is that a risk worth taking? And sometimes it feels like, yeah, it is. And other times it feels like, no, we're on the wrong side of this one. Let's take it out.
Raphael Bob Waxberg is the creator and executive producer of BoJack Horseman. Raphael, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I was great.
Up next on The Frame, Glenn Keane talks about working with Kobe Bryant on the Oscar-winning animated film Dear Basketball. Tonight, the LA Lakers play their first game since the death of Kobe Bryant, his daughter, and seven other people last Sunday. There's expected to be a pregame tribute in honor of all those who perished. When Bryant retired from the game 4 years ago, after 20 seasons with the Lakers, he penned a goodbye letter that he called Dear Basketball. It was later turned into an animated short film by veteran animator Glenn Keane, with music by John Williams, the composer for Star Wars and other classic films. Dear Basketball earned an Academy Award in 2018 for Kobe and for Glenn Keane. Earlier this week, Keane told me he had never met the basketball legend prior to their collaboration.
That day, he showed up with Vanessa and the girls, and we brought him in, and there was this moment of, like, what's Kobe going to think of this tiny little studio? It was in a little duplex, and I mean, it wasn't like the big fancy studios. And you looked around and saw the sketches on the wall. And, you know, for a moment I thought, oh, I know he's got to be disappointed. And he said, it's perfect.
Yeah. The recording of Kobe's monologue, his read comes off as very intimate. What conversations did you have with him about the recitation of the piece? Did you sort of guide him or coach him at all?
We walked down the street from our little studio to a recording studio at the end of Poinsettia. It's a recording studio where actually Michael Jackson, he recorded Thriller. And Kobe was so nervous to go in there. Like this, I mean, he's such a fan of Michael Jackson's work. Mm. And when we came time to record, Kobe was very quiet. He delivered it in a very simple, straightforward, conversational way. I thought, okay, good. Well, he's got that done. Now he's going to deliver something more dramatic. Second time, exactly the same. Third time, delivered it exactly the same. And at that point, I realized this is it. Kobe is going to deliver something very pure, entirely sincere, not inflected, not dramatized. He is not performing. He's revealing who he is. And it became the driver for the way every part of this whole piece was going to be.
I am wondering if he was thinking in terms of creating something that would speak for itself after he was gone, not only from the basketball court, but from from life? And was he thinking about his legacy and future generations and how they viewed him?
For Kobe, he knew what he had done in setting a path for others. So this was his purpose, very much to inspire new generations beyond him. I mean, that was very intentional. Talking to Kobe, he would have this intense, fierce look in his eyes that would... his spirit in this movie, it had to connect to you in a very visceral way, like him. And I told Kobe, I can't just animate you moving across and shooting the ball. I have to know what's in your head, what's in your heart. How are you feeling? And so we went shot by shot through YouTube of Kobe's 20 greatest plays, and he remembered every moment and described that moment, why he was able to do that shot, what was his intention. I could live in his skin. I mean, that's what was... For an animator, it's all about living in the skin of someone you animate. I mean, there was his fade shot where he would throw his right hip out a little bit, and left hip was just back just far enough. And then, you know, he would come at the opponent and then back off and leap up into the air at a certain angle and do the whole thing. And I studied it and I knew it. I knew it exactly, the angle of his hand. And so, early on I said, Kobe, you've got the worst basketball player in the world animating you. He said, that's okay, Glenn, because everything you learn about basketball is going to be through studying him. So after the film was done, we were at the Lakers training center and the lights were off on the court, and I walked in and grabbed a basketball. I thought, I can do this. I mean, and this was so much about Kobe. You just set your mind to it and you study and you can do it. So I got the ball and I went way back into a three-point shot. I mean, way back. I wasn't making it easy on myself. And I dribbled the ball and then I jumped and threw my right hip out and my hand. It was 90 degrees, everything, and all the way to releasing the ball. And Kobe would say, you know, even after the ball was off of his fingertips, I felt like I still had enough control. Like if I pulled my finger back, it might just not bounce too hard on the backboard. I mean, it was like this mystical connection of between him and the ball. And I felt all of that. And as I released the ball, it was flying. I mean, I could not believe it, straight for the basket on a perfect arc. I mean, I was dumbfounded. And then it fell 10 feet short. But...
How do you read the words now in the aftermath of this tragedy?
There's a profound depth to them about him talking about his body not being able to go on. It's time to give it up, time to let it go.
I did everything for you. Because that's what you do when someone makes you feel as alive as you've made me feel. You gave a six-year-old boy his Laker dream. And I'll always love you for it.
There was a moment where we had animated him walking into the tunnel, and it was first animated with him walking into the dark. And we felt that, this isn't right. He's not going away. So we changed it to walking into the light, into something new, into another purpose beyond. And it was very clear at that point for me that this was about a legacy that went far beyond Kobe. And it became very clear to me this was about after Kobe is gone, this legacy will continue on and touch many, many people. So there was inherent in that something that was that was really lasting.
Glenn Keane is a veteran animator and the director of the 2017 Oscar-winning animated short Dear Basketball, featuring the words and the voice of the late Kobe Bryant. Mr. Keane, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Love you always, Kobe.
And that's all for this week. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks to the team that produces the show and to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. We're back here Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center.